ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, please be aware this conversation includes the name of someone who has died.
A few years back, I got invited to this Burns Night event at the Sydney Opera House. The whole thing was pretty raucous and joyful, and it brought together the Scottish Highlands with Australian Indigenous culture. It was literally bagpipes meeting the didgeridoo. It was a very merry evening, full of music and humour. I was wondering who could put on such an original and enjoyable thing, until I saw Rhoda Roberts sitting alone at a table at the back. She was like fiercely concentrating as she was watching the event unfold, and then it all made sense. Rhoda was the head of Indigenous programming at the Opera House at the time. She was at work and I didn't want to break her concentration, but I thought I should just say hi and tell her what a brilliant idea I thought it was. And when I gingerly came up to her table, she jumped out of her chair and she gave me this great big hug. Rhoda Roberts, who died late last month after a long illness, was like that. And we were lucky to have her as long as we did. Rhoda was a Widjebol Waibal woman of the Bundjalung Nation. And I have to tell you, we all thought Rhoda was magic around here. There are very few people we've had on Conversations, I think, with such breadth of imagination who've done so much to connect the ancient energies of this land to the modern world. The arc of Rhoda's life was amazing. Coming out of school, she became a nurse, then a journalist, an actor. She was the first Indigenous person to host a current affairs TV program, just beating out Stan Grant. She was one of the people who helped create the Welcome to Country ceremony. She was a creative director of the majestic Awakening segment of the Sydney Olympic Games opening ceremony, which was a kind of welcome to country for the entire planet. In the middle of her preparation for the Olympics, Rhoda was told that her sister, her twin sister Lois, was missing, which was the beginning of a horrible ordeal for her and her family, and must have been so hard to carry. Rhoda Roberts was an exceptionally talented, creative woman who accomplished so much, but I wouldn't want you to think she was driven and humourless. Rhoda was generous, warm, and funny. She gave so much of herself because there was so much to give. I spoke to Rhoda way back in 2016. Hi, Rhoda.
Hi, Richard.
Rhoda, you're a Bundjalung woman. Where's your country?
So our territories go to around three rivers. In the north, our boundary is the Logan River. In Queensland, to the west, the Condamine. And to the south, the Lower Clarence River.
It's a pretty big country. Where were your ancestors sent once they were forced off their land around the Lismore area?
Well, we have very many clan groups, like most nations and territories. I belong to the Widjebol clan group of the nation, and we exist from Nimbin in the west right down to Evans Head, across to our salt waters, wonderful beach, and, of course, Lismore, Wairala and various other places cross those boundaries. Our family, when the whites first came through as cedar cutters, had a place at a place called Wairala. That was their home base. And then, of course, they had their summer and winter estates, west, east and north. They were rounded up and placed on Cabbage Tree Island, which was, in a way, in hindsight, we're very lucky that the missionaries at the time rounded Aboriginal people up. And on the north coast, there's many islands within the river systems. And so they created these islands as missions.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's a fair way south from Lismore, Cabbage Tree Island. It's outside of Newcastle, isn't it?
Around part. There is Cabbage Tree Island in Newcastle, but this is near Wardell, Ballina.
Oh, okay.
So it's towards the saltwater country.
How like Australia to have two Cabbage Tree Islands
yes.
on the same coast?
Yeah, there's Cabbage Tree Island everywhere.
So is that where your father grew up, on Cabbage Tree Island?
My father grew up on Cabbage Tree Island. And then while he was a young man, his father, who was a very political and savvy man, questioned the mission manager, who was an alcoholic, and, of course, there was some inappropriate behaviour of his. And so in the middle of the night, my grandfather asked the other families on the island, would they be prepared to leave? So he gathered up his family and several others, and they rowed across to the mainland and then walked throughout the night on the old song line, which is Wairala Road, right through to the outskirts of Lismore, where the market gardeners, who were Indians from India, allowed them to stay, and they remained there for a little while until the council came and pushed them off their lands once again. And eventually they ended up building a mission at a place called Tuncester, and that was known as Kabawee, place of plenty.
How connected was your grandfather and your great-grandfather to the old culture?
There's a wonderful quote my grandfather says after he's telling an ABC journalist in the 60s the song line that existed across our country down to the salt water, from the sweet waters right down to the fresh water and salt waters of the East Coast. And as he's singing it, the journalist questions him and he says, the journalist was called Mr. Gordon, and he says, you know, I grew up with the old tribal people and I'm not ashamed of it. And I love that he refers to that being like it's a bad thing. He grew up very much with the old people. His father was the last fully initiated man of the Bundjalung. Well, all my family, my father's grandfathers, uncles, aunties, all spoke language fluently. And I think they were quite visionary in they realised that perhaps with the different policies that were existing, and I often term them as the outlaws. When it was outlawed that you weren't allowed to speak your language or practice your dance, my family, the Roberts, ensured it did continue.
I can't but notice the way you talk about that area. You sort of intersperse it with phrases about the land and the quality of the land and the rivers and all that kind of thing. That's really commonplace. It seems like you was kind of orienting yourself in a specific place in your own mind when you talk like that about the land. Is that what you're doing? What's going on there?
I don't know how you say it without it saying a bit wanky, I guess, but how Aboriginal people are connected to country. I just love the North Coast. We are so lucky, one, that the missionaries put us on Cabbage Tree Island because they lived an incredible life. They built their own co-op. They started sugarcane. They were the best cane teams on the North Coast. There was this work ethic, but there was always this connection to country and what it means to us, even today. I'll drive down Wairala Road, which was the original song cycle that we would take the trade route. And I tell my kids, well, this is your estates. All you can see with your eye is our country, is our home, is our land.
Tell me about your dad, because I've seen video footage of your dad, and he's a remarkable man. He was a preacher within the church. Just give me a sense of his character, please, Rhoda.
I guess many of the articles I read about my dad from those early newspaper clippings was that he was dogmatic. And I remember there was an article that hit the Australian and was on the front page. And it was my dad who had gate crashed an LJ Hooker meeting. It must have been an AGM or something, and demanded to know why land was being sold at a percentage going back to LJ Hooker. And did they not consider looking at land and offering some money to the Aboriginal groups? And that's what he was. He really believed in ensuring that people knew how, and of course he referred in those days as the natives of Australia. He was an orator, incredible orator. And I think because he came from that background of the missionaries, they did, he was a pastor. There were many people in our families who were pastors. And I think the church was often used as a place where people could meet because it was, again, against the law for more than six Aboriginals to gather. So the church became this front where they could have discussions about what was happening in the community.
All right, just like the civil rights movement in the United States with African-American people meeting in churches around the South.
Very much. And, of course, my father was very influenced by the civil rights movement. He'd spent much time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at a place called the Oral Roberts University, which was one of the first theological colleges across the states and still there today. And of course, one of their alumni was Martin Luther King. My dad was there at the same time. They were quite close. They talked very much. Yeah. And so it's pretty amazing. When I was doing the Olympics, actually, I went to Atlanta and I did walk down the avenue to the Martin Luther King Church and saw the plaque with my dad's name. And that was pretty amazing to know that my dad had been there with Dr. King. And they, and of course, Dad was very influenced by his persona and the way that, and of course, he got very involved in those days. The discussions they often had was about the whole Gandhi thing, the non-violent reaction. And so Dad came back with that type of thinking. And Dad then became a member of Fekatsi, which of course was responsible for the 67 referendum yes vote, where 93.7% of Australians voted for us to be counted on the national census. And the following year, my dad was then the chair of Fekatsi, and it became an all-Aboriginal organisation.
How did he meet your mum? How did they get together?
Well, my dad was a pastor. He's very strong about that. And he would talk about fire and brimstone, but he'd do it in language as well, which was pretty great because
wow.
It kept the language going.
Right.
And he met my mother. My dad came from an extreme world of poverty. On his own lands, he was living in an absolute third world conditions in a shanty, even though it had a dirt floor that shone. It was rammed earth, which is now very trendy. My yes. granny had that. But he did come from a place where they didn't have power. They didn't have the necessities of life, I guess, running water. And when he met my mother, he fell immediately in love. She hated him. But eventually, you know, it's the wrong, you know, it's the perfect story.
Why did
you
hate him?
Good girl, wrong side of the tracks, you know. He was late and Dad was so shy, he didn't know whether he should apologise or just keep doing what he was doing. So he just went on and did what he had to do. And she thought he was incredibly rude because he actually didn't apologise for being late. But then, of course, she saw through that and he was very handsome, my dad, too. And my mum used to, when she was younger, she's still an amazing woman. Really, she's amazing. I mean, we're talking, they meet in the 40s and they get married in the 50s. And, of course, this is, again, outlawed. You have to get permission from the New South Wales Aborigines Protection Board to get married because he was marrying a white woman. And that was a very brave thing to do.
For both of them.
For both of them. And both grandparents had the same reaction.
What was that? Well, like
marry
I need to
within
ask
your own people. Yeah. Marry within your own people. Yeah. My white gran, that we call Nanny, she was like, what will happen to these children? They'll be mixed. They won't be one or the other. And my granny, my black granny, was like, what's going to happen to the children? Where are they going to fit? So they had very similar views. And my mother had the view that it didn't matter what colour a child was, it was all about their kinship and where they fitted. And if you gave them the tools of life, then life could be hunky-dory.
It's safe to say you've done okay, Rhoda. I think perhaps those concerns weren't entirely on the money, really, were they? You've done all right, I think.
Done all right, done all right. Yes.
What happened when your dad went over to your mum's parents for dinner for the first time?
Poor Dad. Oh, my gosh, he walked because he was in Sydney, but he had no money. So he used to buy these shirts from, you know, the op shop, but they had no sleeves or anything. So he put his jacket over the top, but he couldn't take it off, and it was a really hot day. So he couldn't take his jacket off. So they thought he was – and so he arrives all sweaty, and they sort of think, And he sits down because he'd never seen an electric light switch, one, so he's pretty amazed
really?
By that.
Wow.
He was 36 years old. And also – he, you know, they had the glasses and the two or three knives and forks, and he, you know, you're lucky to get a knife and fork if you were eating on the mish. And so he followed everything my mother did.
Did that impress the parents, I wonder?
My nana clocked him immediately.
What do you mean?
She saw that he was following what my mum did and thought, wow. So she again said, are you sure, are you sure? He doesn't seem very educated. But, of course, he was extremely educated, even though he'd only gone to sixth grade at the mission school. My dad carried a dictionary with him his whole life, and every week he would learn three new words, and during that week he'd have to use those words in a sentence. And he did the same with us, but reversed it. We had to carry our – he wrote all these picture books with the average our language and pictures, and we'd have to use the language word in a sentence each week.
Wow! So did he teach you the Bible as well? Was it that
oh, yeah.
Bible and the old language as well?
Yeah.
Where did they set up house?
So we were very. When Mum met Dad, Dad would talk about this paradise cabbage tree island between the two rivers, abundance with fish and how fabulous and all wonderful and in this tropical north coast. My mother, when she arrived and saw the mission, said there's no way she could let her children grow up in that environment. And my dad wanted us to grow up knowing who we were and connected to country. So they compromised and they bought a house on the outskirts of Lismore. And we had a pretty, you know, they weren't rich in no sense. Luckily, their parents, mum's parents, put the down deposit for the house. And we grew up, but we spent most of our weekends and much of our holidays out with our grandparents, both sides, but particularly going out each weekend to the mission.
The state was acting in a totalitarian way towards Aboriginal people in these days, telling them who they could marry, what the circumstances, where they could live, all these things, how their children would be brought up. It was really quite totalitarian in the truest sense of the word, in a really creepy way. What did your father think of those rules? What did he tell you about that, those kind of rules that trying to keep Aboriginal people in that state of being, I don't know, what, like children, I suppose, of the state?
I remember a speech he gave going, the native people of this country deserve the right to have a voice. And he was totally against assimilation. Even though I guess if you were to look at him, he's quite assimilated. He, you know, he was one of those Aboriginals who carried the dog tag. Of course, that was a card-carrying little brown book that said that you could enter the town and go to the public library and various other things. They still lived on the curfew, you know, after 6 p.m. you couldn't go into the local town. Rural Australia, even during my childhood, was seething with racism, and I hated it and I would question it. And my father guided me, I guess, in a sense, and he said, but you're just giving them exactly what they expect. This is how they've labelled you and you're reacting exactly to their stereotype. Defy them. Make them think, wow, if they meet you and you're not dirty and you're smart and you can talk and you're proud of who you are and you're not ashamed, they're going to start questioning their assumptions. And so he'd always say, you know, give them something they don't expect and then they'll start to question it. The next time they meet someone, they'll say, oh, not all Aboriginals are like that. And so that was his sort of teachings that he made us. And his biggest thing was that we, as children, all of us in the family, had to volunteer in a job. So from high school, the minute we hit high school, it's like, what are you volunteering at? So, of course, I did Sunday school and things, but also I volunteered as a candy striper at the local hospital.
What's a candy striper?
Yes, a candy striper is because we wore a pink and white candy striped apron, and you would go and help feed the old people, read to them, you know, just do little things around the hospital that the nurses couldn't do. And I did that during my entire high school period.
You had a twin sister growing up, Lois. What were the two of you like together?
Man, we were chalk and cheese. She got the looks. And I used to think that I got the brains, but actually she got the brains as well. She was incredibly smart. She didn't try, though. She was a party girl. She questioned everything. What's the point of her work learning logarithms? I'm not going to use that. This was her attitude to life. So she never really did much schooling. She was quite a rebel.
Who looked after who?
She looked after me. She protected me. If I got, I hated school and I was terrified, although I loved study. I did very well. I was in the school orchestra and I just wanted to play the violin and become a journalist and write books. That was my dream. And, of course, that wasn't possible in Lismore in the 70s. And so she...
Really?
No, absolutely not. Was questioned why I would even want to go on to year 11 and 12. Oh, fifth and sixth form as it was known then. So she would fight my battles for me and she would just laugh in the face of adversity and she'd just go, what, bugger them. She mapped out her world. She knew what she was going to do and no one was going to stop her and she became a hairdresser.
Now, you used to have these recurrent bad dreams when you were little. What were those? What was that dream?
It's so bizarre. I used to have this dream where a ancestral creation spirit we call Durungan, which is like a witch, but she was responsible for looking after the sweet water from the mountains and that go down to the sea. And she hid her water and was a very greedy woman and the sun found the water. And so this witch occurred that she created the water flow that came down the mountain from the tears that she was crying. And I would have her sit on the end of my bed almost weekly in this nightmare. And she'd be making me count. And it was, I'd always get, she'd ask me to count to 300 and I'd only ever get to 245 and then I'd wake up. It was a nightmare, and my parents would be in my room trying to calm me down.
You mean around 245 or 245 exactly?
I would stop at 245 every time, and I think, what did that number mean? What did something, I don't know. So, and of course, when things happened to my sister later at 21, when she had a very severe car accident, I then started to think, oh my gosh, is it something relating to that?
What would happen if you? What did you think would happen if you reached 300? Since she told you to count to 300,
I don't know.
Was it something terrible?
I don't know, but I did carry this little thing, and then the minute I started nursing, I never had that dream again. It's really weird, but it did. My young childhood, I had these nightmares consistently, and I also would predict people who were going to die, and my father would say, "You must never say that. You shouldn't talk about the spirits like that." But I'd be like, "Dad, they're going to die tomorrow." And of course they would. My aunties, my grandfather, everyone, I would predict when they were going to die. It was.
How would you know? How would you be? Would you? Were you told?
They'd come and tell me in my dreams, in this dream, this nightmare, they'd be there. So it's quite, yeah.
Oh, that's a horrible thing to have in your life. Would you want to, did you try and keep that knowledge to yourself at times?
Both my grandmothers knew, and Mum's mum thought I had the gift. You know, in her family there were people, because she comes from an Irish heritage, there were people who had this gift of, you know, the second sight, they used to call it. And on Granny's side, she just thought, yep, that's what you're here for, Rhoda. You're going to carry the stories. So
you wanted to become a journalist. You moved to Sydney. And when you were 21, just before your 21st birthday, you mentioned that Lois had had this car accident. What were you told? What do you remember being told about that, Rhoda?
I was getting ready to go to work. I was a nurse and the police knocked on my door and I knew instantly, but I knew something had happened as I was about to iron my uniform. The police knocked on the door and said, "Your sister's been in an accident and you need to go home."
So what did you do?
It was the day that restored my faith in that people were people. Human beings were good. I went to work because I was, you know, young and scared that I would lose my job or something. And by the time I got to work, the matron had bought my air ticket to fly me home and the charge sister's husband drove me to the airport.
So that was when you and your dad went to see Lois at the hospital. How was that drive with your dad?
It was really interesting. It was my dad was just so – Lois was his favourite, of course. I didn't really exist, even though I was like his shadow all the time, following him around everywhere. But we were driving, and just before we got to the hospital, a stone from the truck in front of us hit our windscreen, and we could hardly see. I thought Dad was going to have an accident. I was so worried because he was crying the whole way, and I'd really never seen my dad cry like that. And as we stopped, we were outside a windscreen repair station. It was amazing. And so we sat there talking and I kept saying to him, "But you have another daughter." And he then realised, and, you know, it's surprising. It was a terrible time. But it was almost a catalyst for us. We became very close after that. And indeed, Dad then started spending a lot of time with me, coming to Sydney and staying with
me. He saw you properly then for the first
time. Yeah, I think he, because I was away, you know, I was training.
And he was away a lot too, wasn't he?
And he was away. But then when he did come to Sydney, he'd come and stay with me and we got very connected.
So what state was Lois in when you got to the bedside at the hospital?
She was unconscious and they basically said that she had very little brain activity and they had suggested that after a series of tests they could turn off the machines and use her organs for other recipients. My dad and I said, of course. You know, surprisingly, I was in my third year of nursing and I was working in intensive care at the time. So to me, that was, you know, she was being kept alive by a ventilator. My father, on the other hand, being quite a spiritual man and very religious, said, "No, where there's breath, there's life." And so he sent me back to where we were staying. I was really quite I didn't know how to cope with it, I think, because this is my sister. And it's not, I don't know, it's something weird with twins. You're not just a sibling. It's literally like a part of you. You know, you are connected in some way, I guess. And then as I was walking out of, you know, Dad pulled the curtains as I was walking out of the ward, and he was a big man. He jumped up on that bed with her and he had these feathers that he put around her head, and then he started singing. And then when I came back, he was sitting beside with the Bible open. So he'd done our way, our Widgeable way, and then he was doing the God way. And the next day they did the tests and she had increased brain activity. And, of course, 2 years later, after all the rehab, she was walking, talking, independent, and, of course, she went on to have children and a different life to what she had for the first 20 years.
But she wasn't the same, was she?
No, she was never the same, never. And I think at that time in medicine we didn't know enough about head injuries and the different stature of the brain. You know, she was, after the accident, she was often very inappropriate in her behaviour, in her dress. We have diplomacy, and sometimes with head injuries there's that.
Yeah, you get disinhibited, as they say, don't
oh,
you?
Oh, very.
And it's either
very sexual or very religious or, yeah.
So, Rhoda, your career was taking off and you worked as a journalist, you became an actor, touring in theatre shows. How would you know when your father was in the audience, when you were on stage?
He was such an incredible support. And I think my mum questioned, why would I give up nursing to take, you know, to go into vaudeville, which yes. He saw the arts as. Whereas Dad came and saw a theatre show and he realised it was the new platform. He said in the 40s and 50s we had the church where we could tell people, you've now got the theatre. This is the platform for Aboriginal Australia to tell their stories and their thoughts. And I thought, oh, okay. And I did a show with Robin Archer actually called A Quanzo Flies South, and we toured nationally. And Dad would rock up to every theatre on opening night but never tell me. And there was a moment in the play and I hear this little chuckle and I knew it was my father. And then I'd be incredibly nervous because he was in the audience. But, yeah, that was wonderful. He came to every single opening night of that show.
How lovely to hear your dad's laugh in the audience, though. That's delightful. You auditioned for A Current Affairs show for SBS in 1987. When you auditioned for that, had you ever even been on a TV set before?
No, I'd come straight from the theatre. In fact, I flew up from Tasmania for the audition because I was doing a play down there at the time. And I just thought, well, and quite a few people, because I'd been working in radio, my volunteering when I came nursing was to work with Mission Beat. And, of course, my dad was like, what volunteering are you doing in the local community?
Right.
And so I became a volunteer at Radio Redfern, where I got my skills working on radio. And, yeah, so I was still volunteering then. And
you'd never seen a TV studio before?
I'd never been on a TV.
And did you use your natural voice or did you use a broadcast voice?
Oh, no,
Rhoda
darling.
Roberts?
I thought, I'm an actor.
Oh, yes.
This is a current affairs program. So, hi, I'm Rhoda Roberts. And we've got that story. And I did Yana Vent because at the time she was the woman that
she was
the
it,
leading
wasn't she?
Light. And, of course, then I got the job and they said, but you can't. You have to be yourself. So that was a little frightening, actually, and I wasn't that great, let me tell you. I really wasn't.
Yes, you were. You were great. You were yeah.
Not in the first year or two. I, you know, managed to centre myself and learn a lot from some incredible mentors who I approached and asked them to give me advice. Jim Whaley, Paul Murphy and Kerry O'Brien. Those three gentlemen gave me such extraordinary advice about how to do interviews and so forth. And
you see, shallow people would remark on your extreme good-lookingness, Rhoda Roberts, but I, of course, admired your journalistic skills, your incisive mind, your line of questioning, your natural gravitas. That was the thing that I admired the most. Let me just say that.
I was really skinny back then, yeah.
Your dad passed away in the late 1980s. How did you and Lois cope with him? In leaving, yeah.
She was devastated. They were very close. She really, really was devastated. And in a way, and she did the same for my black granny, is she kept their legacy alive. She would remind people who they were consistently. It was really lovely, actually. And surprisingly, she started going to church as well. And when she passed away, you know, it was quite interesting. At the funeral, there were bikies. There were the old, beautiful old ladies from church. There were the CWA ladies. There was the arts community. There was the Nimbin community. It was an absolute smorgasbord, the Aboriginal community, all mixed in one. And it really showed what a great person she was and how she had managed to infiltrate all these subcultures in a way.
After she had kids, she had a son and then a daughter, and she wasn't coping too well. So your mum brought up, Charlie went to your mum and you took on Emily, her daughter. What kind of a change did that make to your life?
An incredible change. I just got married. I'd only been married for a short period of time to Bill Hunter, the late Bill Hunter. And so I was never having children. You know, Bill was a bit older and we were ready to have this great life together. And my sister asked me, would I take this child? Because she knew welfare would take the child from her. And in fact, a family had been lined up. Emily is now 22 years old. And she's quite an extraordinary girl. She is her mother, truly. As I was raising her, I felt like I was living with my sister again because she's got the same sort of mannerisms but also the recklessness and the party animal a bit is our Emily, like her mother. And I think how lucky I am that my sister entrusted her into my care, but at the same time I feel I often... You know, it's so weird. You carry the baggage, don't you? Women, we carry so much baggage. I carry the baggage that why she should have lived and I should have died. Because she was so gregarious and smart. She was 20 times smarter than me. I carry the baggage that I couldn't. Her son, after my father died, mum and dad were raising Charlie and then he was put into foster care and I couldn't get him, although I used to take him on holidays. And then one year I never took him back. But, you know, fighting to get custody of him, to raise the two of them as siblings, I failed her there. And so sometimes I feel like maybe they would have been better off going into families than me, not necessarily because I wasn't maternal in any way. But thank God I'd done nursing because I actually worked out how to raise this child from my experiences as a nurse and, of course, my mum giving me consistent advice. But, you know, my mother is a very maternal, nurturing person and I wasn't. And so, but surprising, when my sister was murdered, it was only a year later I fell pregnant and I've had two of my own children. So Charlie, Emily, Jack and Sarah have all grown up as brother and sister.
There was that moment when you were the creative director of the Awakening segment of the Sydney Olympics, which was an incredible act of diplomacy and imagination, and it was a complete triumph, and it was so beautiful and thrilling to watch. It was in the preparation for that you were told that Lois had gone missing. What were you told at the time?
My brother rang me absolutely distraught. He'd been down to the police station. He realised that she hadn't been home, and head injury people are very particular and habitual about what they do on a daily basis, and so he was... you know, adamant that something had happened to her. And of course, her groceries had been delivered and she hadn't taken them inside. And that was money, that was food, that was really important to her because she didn't have much. So he was ringing me, though, to come home because he was too scared to go back to the police station. He felt that they saw him just as a black man and that he had issues because of his substance abuse and so forth, that they weren't taking him seriously. So I did go home and my mum was a mess. You know, she'd just lost her husband and now she'd lost her daughter. Or, well, her daughter was missing. I spent 3 hours in the police station and, you know, I can laugh about it now, but I actually, at the time, Bill's agent was Harry M. Miller. And so I rang him and said, you know, I'm going into this police station. They're not going to take me seriously. Will you call and say that you're going to do this big media thing about my sister being missing? And so he did. And they were going, no, we have our own media unit. And And it was literally his call that made them, because I said, you're not doing anything. She's been missing for 10 days. You need, and they wouldn't put a missing persons report in. And what hit me was, it was almost like a slap in the face. And it was a young police officer that I knew. I went to school in Lismore, and often there are people from my year that tell me that I've got a bit too big for my boots, considering I'm a Roberts and I'm a black fella from Lismore. And he had that attitude, and it really, and he said, look, she's just gone walkabout, you know, she, because, and then he proceeded to tell me the sort of issues that were occurring with her and taxi drivers and what she was, the services she was providing some elements of our community.
All right, so therefore police shouldn't care.
Yeah. That she'd gone walkabout, she was with some bloke, and I shouldn't even worry. I just knew there was something going on. And so I just persevered anyway. We finally, that day, it took 3 hours for them to put a missing persons report in.
6 months later, after she was reported missing, her body was found by someone in the middle of the bush. She had clearly been held captive by someone. What, her wrists were bound?
With the coroner's inquiry that occurred, there was two ligature marks on her wrist, suggesting that she'd been held for a period of time prior to actually dying and then being tied again. And that was quite disturbing when we started to get all this information. And when you look at the Wine State Forest in northern New South Wales, and it is the most pristine, amazing forest, it's absolutely beautiful. But it would be like a needle in a haystack, how you could ever find a body there. I truly believe there was a walker and he needed to go to the toilet. I truly believe my father or someone guided him, because I just don't know how he ever found that body. I go there all the time now, and it's started to regrow back, and you have to literally climb your way in. So it's quite surprising she was found. So I guess we're lucky in that sense, that we have that sort of, we know we have her body and we're able to give her, you know, that respect and burial. But still, we need to know what happened to her. We need to find those answers, because it's not just her. There are many women, including our cousin Lucy McDonald, who has disappeared and her body has never been found. There are so many girls on the North Coast, and because we live in a world where many of our communities have very different lifestyles happening, people are very transient. They change their names.
So many women have gone missing from that area.
Many, many women have gone, over 21 that haven't been solved and in the North Coast.
And just Aboriginal women or non-Aboriginal women as well?
Mostly Aboriginal women. There have been some non-Aboriginal, but there are quite a few Aboriginal women who have been murdered, and their cases, you know, in fact, two in the last few months have been solved, but a lot are just sitting there uninvestigated. Look, and I understand that police have limited resources, but I do remember one police officer, and I can't remember his name. And again, it was that little moment that gives you faith in human beings. Because the Lismore police were, I'm sorry, I just, they so disrespected my sister. Just saying she'd gone walkabout or that she was prostituting herself meant that she didn't need to be investigated. She was a mother. She was a, you know, she actually gave a lot to the community. She was a human being. And I, look, finding whoever did it is never going to bring her back. But my gosh, I would hate to see another family truly go through what we've gone through. You know, this changes your life. It changes your every day. Maybe I am so lucky and fortunate that I have wonderful children, a wonderful family. I come from the oldest living culture. I have all that connection. And then I'm able to keep myself on an even keel, I guess, because I can throw everything back into the passion I have for the arts and the work I do. If I didn't have that, I don't know what I'd be doing. I think I'd be a mess.
I can't even begin to imagine what it's like to live with that kind of horror. in your life? I don't know how you do it, and I don't know how you even manage it. Does it shift from horror to something else after a while?
Yeah, it does. You know, it's so stupid. Oh, I'm so stupid. It shifts to, like, you blame yourself that you didn't participate in their lives enough, or you feel guilty because you're here. Like, you, all these other emotions.
That's not fair.
It's just silly. And you know it's silly, but it's just the way, I guess, people survive in varying ways. And, you know, we've seen, you know, I think of Holocaust survivors, how they feel.
That's survivor's guilt of a kind.
Yeah, it's a bit like that in a way, that you go, right, well, okay, I'm here. What am I going to do with my life? It does, look, on one hand, it gives you that strength, and it tells you, right, well, you got to look at what you're doing. You can't be trivial about things. Why are you here? So maybe that does give me that drive of going, I want to ensure that every Australian has an experience with Aboriginal culture. I want them to come and see how we laugh. Oh, my God, we're the greatest comedians, and yet people are too scared to laugh with us. We have the greatest jokes. It's very Irish, you know. It's so Australian and so larrikin in a way. But I want people to see the old dance and to see the new dance. I want people to hear the music and just go, isn't this fantastic? Australia, this is Australia. And let's embrace it all. And so maybe that's what I'm here for, is just to make sure that as many people as possible get to experience what I've experienced.
Right. One thing I've noticed is a theme with the arts work you've done, or journalistic work over the years, is to try and do away with this moth-eaten old idea, which we don't hear so much of anymore, that our Aboriginal people in this country must speak with one voice. I mean, it's self-evidently foolish to go on like that. There has to be, and will inevitably be, multiplicity of voices and arguments between Aboriginal people, just like there would be anyone else. How important is that to you as an idea to sort of move you along through the culture?
You know, it's quite extraordinary where that idea and thought that people are too scared to say something because it's not in agreement with everyone.
Mm.
Or that it's too worthy. And, you know, we have very many voices. We have good voices. We have bad voices. We have voices like Trump, God forbid. We even had Aboriginals joining the One Nation Party.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is how diverse we are. But I think we should allow that debate and that discussion and hear that dialogue, because it is quite interesting. It really gives you a flavour of where Aboriginal people are coming from. You know, back perhaps in the 70s when I was growing up, I didn't know an Aboriginal family who was rich. They were rich in, you know, culture and so forth, but not in a monetary sense. Now we actually have an Aboriginal middle class. And that is incredibly surprising and amazing. But they have a very different voice to my cousins who still live on the mission, who are no longer on the bottom of the rung. They've actually fallen back down to the dirt. And so we need to hear that voice. It's as vibrant and as important as the voice of our leaders or this new middle class. All our voices are important. But the importance is that we do have the diversity.
You still have Emily in your life, like I said, Lois's daughter. Do you see Lois in her all the time?
More often than not, you know, particularly as she's getting older, and her Lois for the first 20 years of her life was, you know, the gregarious party girl. Life was just one big ball, and don't worry, you're going to be dead one day, so just enjoy everything around you. I guess Emily's a little bit like that. She hopefully will get more disciplined. My younger ones are more disciplined than she is.
Most teenagers are like that, aren't they?
Yeah.
Inevitably, if you're bringing up your sister's daughter, would there have to be a moment where you try to discipline her as a teenager and she'd go, what do you know? You're not my mum. Would you have had that moment, Rhoda Roberts?
Yes, I've had that moment.
I've had that moment.
It came earlier than I thought.
Did it?
But one thing about Emily is she is so smart. She's so smart, just like her mother.
And how did she do it? What would you do when she said that to you? How did you manage that?
Oh, I sat her down and I said, well, boy, you are so disassociated with your culture because actually, culturally, I am your mother. Two mothers, Nami Hindu, you know, of course, in our culture, the aunties are mothers as well. And so she was like, and I said, you will never, ever say that again.
One of the things I like most about the awakening ceremony, the opening of the, I keep banging on about this, I know.
It was fantastic.
It was fantastic. But I think it was a really wonderful way of letting the whole country feel proud. Is that the word? I don't know what it is, but delighted in Indigenous culture in Australia. So we took real pleasure in it in that moment. I certainly did.
It was incredible because it wasn't just worthy. We had the spirituality of that song. And of course, with Stephen Page's incredible choreography and the song men of Mr. Nundrabilla from Numbawa and Jakapora Manyaran and the ladies from the Central Desert with their Inmar and then the celebration of the Torres Straits showed how much fun we can have and also made very distinctive how different we all are and we were all dancing to the one rhythm. So we have different voices, but we can all have the one rhythm.
Indeed. It's been fantastic speaking with you, Rhoda. I've been wanting to have you on the show for such a long time. I'm so glad we were able to make it actually happen at long last. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
That was my conversation with Rhoda Roberts, who died in late March after a long illness. I spoke with her in 2016. The case of Lois Roberts' murder near Nimbin in northern New South Wales in 1998 remains unsolved. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Turrbal and Jagera peoples. The producer was Georgia Bateman. Executive producer was Pam O'Brien. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.